Back together again, brand new week, you and I chatting it up, Monday, April the 28th style, 2025, right here on Connecticut Today. We looked at a proposal to possibly increase the use of automated speed cameras on the state's major highways as soon as next year. Sacred Heart University Associate Professor for Catholic Studies, Dr. Dan Robert, dropped by to talk about the upcoming conclave to select a new pope. Connecticut News Junkie columnist and Substack.com blogger Terry Cowgill also stopped by to chat about President Trump and the Connecticut Attorney General William Tong's fight with Avello. Former University of New Haven Sports Information Director Eric McDowell talked about the passing of Bridgeport native and legendary Connecticut coach Larry Porky Vieira. And CBS News Justice Correspondent Scott McFarland joined us to detail the recent arrest of a Milwaukee judge in a controversial immigration case.
So I know a lot of you folks are not going to like it, but I'll just tell you right up front, it seems, according to the story I caught in the Hartford Current here, kind of an under-the-radar story here. But according to the story in the Hartford Current, it looks like, yes, I know you're not going to like it. You're going to cry and bitch and moan. Well, too bad. More speed cameras are coming to the major interstates in the state, in particular I-95. You remember a couple of years ago when they put those speed cameras up at construction sites, particularly I think one stretch was in Norwalk on I-95. There were a couple of three other sites in the state. And I was here on the show and everybody was saying, hey, slow down through these construction zones, slow down, because if you don't slow down, you're going to get more of these cameras. Well, guess what? You're getting more of the cameras. I know people don't like it. They're already bitching and moaning on Facebook about it. I get it. I understand it. But it's apparently going to happen. According to the Hartford Current, a story here by Sean Kropsik, new bill out there seeks to expand speed cameras on Connecticut highways. You know why? Because in just three locations, remember, they did this pilot program years ago. It was three locations. Three. They ended up handing out 25,000 warnings from three locations. They did this back in 2023, and I was warning you to slow down, tap the brakes. No. You didn't listen to me. New bill being quietly circulated in Hartford. It passed the Transportation Committee, and they're going to have a plan in place, says here, if the bill gets a final yes vote, you're going to have a plan on expanded camera photo radar, speed camera use. That plan is going to be in place less than a year from now, by February 1, 2026. On all state roads, it would also, quote, get this now, here's a quote for you, permit a municipality to use any funds generated from the use of an automated traffic safety device to reimburse a vendor for the expenses included with the design, installation, operation, and maintenance of such device. So that means that people who speed will be paying the state to write them a ticket. I love it. I'm serious. I love this. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Seriously, I know you're going to call me up and scream at me. Go ahead, because they warned you about this over and over and over and over and over again when we talked about it 2 months ago. 24,900 warnings issued by the state saying, hey, we're not going to fine you now, but slow down. And apparently, people are still speeding through construction zones, still driving like idiots. So you know what I say? Bring it on. I love it. Let's go. Well, you know, Paul, it's just going to bring in money that won't lower my taxes. I don't care. I see enough idiocy. I see enough morons on the road that it the time again today I got passed on the right side, got cut off by a guy doing over 80 miles an hour. He needs to get a ticket. Well, you know, Paul, the state shouldn't be generating revenue. Guess what? I don't care. If you're going to drive like a jackass, put up the speed cameras. I love it. I swear I do. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. The proposed bill, this is House Bill 7085, requires the DOT to develop a plan to expand speed camera use on state roads, and that plan is going to have to be in place, if the bill is passed, by February 1 of next year. Amen, hallelujah. Start cranking out those tickets. I'm telling you. You know why? Well, are you worried about getting fined, Paul? Yeah, I am, but it'll teach me to slow down. Because, yeah, I speed too. I'll admit it. Hi, my name is Paul, and I'm here in the group because I speed too. But how dumb, how arrogant do you have to be after you're warned by the media for weeks, a couple of years ago, that they did this? I remember talking about this, telling people to slow down, and still you have 24,000 people who don't care. They don't care. So when you don't care, that's what happens. You agree with me or not? In fact, it's up as one of our Facebook questions of the day. We start off, do you support a proposed bill in Hartford that would expand the use of speed cameras on state highways? Absolutely, I'm for it, especially when they warn you and you're coming up speed enforcement ahead and you still speed. That, boys and girls, is a special kind of stupid. And by the way these cameras work, you don't get a ticket the first time, you know. You get a warning. So you'll get a warning. You will get a letter from the state pretty much saying, hey, you're acting like a cavone here. Pick up the lead foot a little bit. Slow down. And then subsequently, you get fined. And again, we're up and underway here. New show, new week here on WICC, talking about the fact that there is a bill slowly, quietly making it through Hartford. That if it is finally passed and it, you know, just came out of committee, it has not been voted on yet. May not be, but I think it will. That would mean that by next February 1st, there'll be a plan likely in place to install more speed enforcement cameras on Interstate 95, I-91, the major state roads, the Merritt, places like that. And I'm already getting angry responses to this. No, it's not going to lower my taxes, whatever. Stuff like this is not made to lower your taxes, with all due respect. I understand what you're saying. But this is not for tax mitigation and tax abatement. It's to give people who, you know, can't really understand, they have to slow down, at least through construction zones. It's to give those people what's known as a dope slap in the head. And sometimes people need a dope slap. You remember, they did this on a trial basis about a year and a half ago. And even though it was publicized on shows like this all over the place, on the news, in print, TV, radio, they still, in 2023, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December. So in 9 months, a 9 month stretch, in late 2023 into 2024, they had to issue warnings with these speed cameras that were set up at construction zones. 24,900 warnings. And they also gave out 750 tickets because people wouldn't slow down. I love it. Let's go. Let's keep doing it. I got past the other day in a construction zone. I saw some idiot, you know, basically almost knocked the hat off of somebody in a construction zone. So again, I know you're, you know, you're Your initial reaction to this is going to be, well, why are they doing it? Well, I mean, they're doing it because there are people out there that don't care, and it's sad. It really is sad. And guess what? The state is saying that where they did this, guess what? People got the message eventually, and they lowered their speed. Speeding was reduced at two work zones on I-95 by 17 to 18% as people, you know, eventually got the idea here. So listen, I know a lot of people don't like this, but the cameras are coming. And the reason the cameras are coming is because people will not slow down. I'm all for this. Do you like this? I don't mind it. Maybe if I get a warning or a ticket or two, I'll learn to slow down. Maybe that's what it takes. Even a stooge like me. The questions up here on our Facebook page, facebook.com/voiceofct. Do you support a proposed bill in Hartford that would expand the use of speed cameras on state highways? Yes or no? Paul says no. Is it going to lower my taxes? Paul, no. But, you know, with all due respect, that's not what this is for. This is to hit people in the pocketbook who are speeding, particularly through construction zones. John says, nope, he's not for it. Dave says, absolutely. 91, 84, and 691 of the Merritt Parkway are racetracks now. People need to slow down. They do. They do. Even me. I need to slow down sometimes. Maybe one or two tickets will make me slow down. I told you, the last ticket I actually got was rolling through a stop sign at 2 in the morning, and there was a cop there. And guess what? I still go through that stop sign or stop at that stop sign probably 2 or 3 days a week, not at 2 in the morning anymore. But guess what? Now I come to a full stop. We have a text message in on this one already. Hi, Paul. Put cameras all over Route 8. I don't blame you. You know, I'm not on Route 8 a lot. But I was on Route 8 about 2 or 3 months ago, middle of the day. I'm like, wow, is this the green flag at NASCAR? Jesus. Oh, and believe me, I like driving fast. I do. But man, oh, man, I'm sitting there doing 70, 75, and I'm getting past like I'm standing still. Steve in Fairfield kicks it off today at 23 after. Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good, good, good. I want to know how many of these drivers are from Connecticut.
Well, I don't know. I'm sure they have the data. I guess you still have to pay the ticket.
Well, I know, but I just think that, you know, there's the highway. It's a highway system, maybe in our state, but it's a federal highway system.
Yeah.
And are these cameras, are they permanent? Are they just for specific sites? And my, it doesn't pass the smell test to me.
Why not?
Because it sounds like the preparation for another tax. Hey, it's working in these no-go zones, so why don't we just put it all over every road? I can just see it coming. They can't control spending, so they're going to find any outlet that they can.
Well, there's an easy way, Steve. People could also slow down.
Well, I know, but for those of us who don't,
but
a lot of times you get in situations, and if you're going to have a camera, it's not going to be an officer talking to you and mm-hmm. maybe making a judgment. Mm-hmm. Now, I have been in situations where I see it coming up, and I want to move over, and I can't, and the guy behind me is pushing me forward, and before I know it, I'm passing the work zone. In a speed that I feel I shouldn't be.
No, you're right. You're right. It's happened to me too, Steve. But I guess what the DOT is saying is, if we do enough of these, and Steve, thank you for the call. I have to run. But seriously, I guess what the DOT is saying is that if we do enough of these, eventually everybody will slow down to a point that it's palatable. And they say in these two test areas, eventually people drop their speeding by about 20%. Steve, I understand you're this is not perfect. I get it. I understand it. And I think you and me, we may be the exception here rather than the rule. And the rule, Stephen, thank you for the call. Unfortunately, the rule is a lot of Cavone's behind the wheel. I want to talk about this, which, of course, for the last week or so, has been a worldwide story, the death and this past weekend's internment of the late Pope Francis, the leader of the Catholic Church. 1.5 billion people around the globe, including hundreds of thousands here in Connecticut. Joining us right now to talk about what's ahead for the upcoming conclave. Is it going to look like the movie? Was that just Hollywood license? Is Dr. Dan Rober. He's the Associate Professor of Catholic Studies right down the road at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Dr. Rober, hi. It's Paul here. Good afternoon. How are you?
Great to be with you, Paul. I'm doing fine.
And did I see that we have a date now for the conclave, Dr. Rober? Did I see that was laid out?
Yes.
Well, how's that going to look?
So they announced that they're going to get started a week from Wednesday, May 7th. So they gave themselves a little extra time before they got started, actually relative to when they could have technically started based on the sort of minimum requirement of 15 days from when the Pope dies or resigns.
So there are, what, Dan, 200 and change cardinals, but not all of them will be voting, correct? There's an age cutoff, right?
Yes. So the age cutoff, which was instituted during the papacy of Paul VI back in the 1960s and 70s, is age 80. So there's, you know, traditionally supposed to be around 120 cardinals under 80 who vote. There'll be about, I think, 135 this year, give or take, who actually makes it. There's always a few who, for health and other reasons, can't make it. But so it'll be like 130-something people.
And Dan, I have read, have I not, over the past couple of years that, look, the Pope Francis knew his physical state, knew that he was gradually declining. So a lot of the cardinals he named recently, he did that, am I right? Did I read correctly? Knowing maybe how they would vote for his successor? Is that true?
Well, the funny thing with the conclave is you never quite know how things are going to go. There's always going to be surprises, but certainly Francis was somebody who appointed cardinals who he thought shared his vision of the church. And he also appointed cardinals from a wider variety of places than his predecessors did, right? From places around the world that might not have had a cardinal before, whereas like some major places, you know, like in our country, like Los Angeles or Philadelphia, that might not have had cardinals, might have had cardinals in the past, don't now, whereas like now we have a cardinal from Newark. Right, he took a little bit more of a freewheeling approach to that. And he certainly did. He named some cardinals last year, right? So he's named around 80% of them, which, I mean, he was Pope for 12 years, so that's, not surprising in a certain sense.
Boy, I tell you, Dan, they are, despite all the whispering, are the cardinals pretty tight-lipped, actually, about what goes on in these conclaves? I mean, you don't hear, other than the black smoke or the white smoke, right? We don't really know a lot about what happens, or do we?
So once the conclave actually starts, you don't hear anything about what's going inside during the conclave. Now, there are books that are written after the fact that are of interest, mostly because they're not Insta books, right? They tend to be like serious journalistic books that take a few years to write. Where you will actually get some information about what happened inside, even though technically it's kind of like hush hush. But what I will say is, and this is one of the differences between reality and the movie, is that a lot of the conversations that took place in the movie are actually happening right now during what's called the congregation, where the cardinals are meeting from now until the conclave starts. And those are not as airtight as the conclave, in the sense that, you know, things will kind of get in and out of there. And there's certainly always a lot of media attention, especially in Italy, around different candidates and stories that come out about different candidates during the conclave that can't make a candidate, but can certainly sink a candidate.
Dr. Dan Rober is the guest, Associate Professor of Catholic Studies at Sacred Heart University. I know some people, Dan, and I'm assuming you saw the movie. Correct me if you didn't. I have not seen it, and I'll probably stream it eventually. I know some people who loved it, and I know some people who were literally snoozing 10 minutes in. What? Give us your unsolicited review here of how you think the movie Conclave might actually play this whole thing out in reality.
Sure. Well, I mean, as a movie, right, it's a chamber drama, right, that's upping the dramatic stakes of a conclave, but still very much portraying a conclave.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be interested in church drama of a bunch of guys in Renaissance rooms talking about issues related to the church,
yeah.
Right? They're not, you know, rappelling down skyscrapers or anything. You know, this is not Die Hard.
No.
So, and again, the movie in certain respects is very realistic about the kind of politics that there are politics, there are factions, and certainly in terms of kind of the technicalities of how the voting goes, it's pretty accurate. But like I said, a lot of the actual politics and the kind of decisions about who the major candidates are going to be are taking place right now in these congregations and meetings, and also in the media. There certainly is, like I said, a lot that goes on in the media that gets to the cardinals that does certainly make a difference in terms of making it more difficult for some candidates to be elected.
And I would imagine you're right, Dan. Once they get behind closed doors, I wonder if you have a scenario, maybe reflected as we have in our Congress here, but maybe those, correct me if I'm wrong, countries that have parliamentary governments where they're trying to build consensus among groups like, hey, I know my guy doesn't have enough support, but I can team up with somebody because, yeah, I'd be okay with him as a number two because he reflects my values. Does that go on? Is there deal-making once the doors close?
Yes, both informally and formally, in a sense that, like, when the initial vote, right, because, the first couple of ballots, right, you are very unlikely to see white smoke, right, because it takes a while for them to suss out who the serious candidates are, right, how much traction anybody has, and then to kind of shift around a little bit. Although, again, a lot of that is starting to become clear before they even get in there, because they've seen who's impressive and who's not. They've seen who has had things floated in the media that are acceptable and not acceptable. It is a situation where if your preferred candidate clearly isn't getting anywhere, you're going to look to latch on to somebody who is acceptable, even if not ideal, rather than pave the way for somebody who is unacceptable. And again, you're trying to get to a 2/3 majority.
Yeah.
Now, there is a stipulation that if they're voting for essentially a couple of weeks and they don't get a 2/3 majority, that it would go to a simple majority. But that would be very unlikely to happen because that would, frankly, set up that Pope for a really rocky time if they were coming in and being seen as barely legitimate by a lot of people in terms of the number of votes they would have gotten.
And finally, as to the specific candidates, without getting too much into the minutia, Dan, I'm seeing a list here, and it's interesting. You've got some people who would consider what people would say were Francis's progressive reforms, and then you've got some cardinals who would kind of be stay the course, and then I saw two or three on there that would kind of move it back toward, you know, Pope Benedict here. So is that what you're seeing? There's kind of a cornucopia of candidates here, are there not?
Well, again, there's always, you know, different kind of varieties and factions of candidates that are being floated ahead of a conclave. You know, and some of them will be serious candidates once they actually get in there, and some won't. So if you believe fellow Connecticut native and resident Michael Sean Winters, who also is a fellow here at Sacred Heart, he wrote in National Catholic Reporter this morning that he doesn't think the conservative cardinals, for example, have enough support to even block a candidate, much less get someone elected. If that were true, that would certainly hurt the candidacy, realism of the candidacy of people associated with that group. But generally speaking, right, who the candidates are is going to depend on what the priorities are in the discussions over this week and into next week, right? Are the priorities those that Francis had of, right, standing up for kind of the marginalized, right, pushing back against the rise of authoritarian politics in various parts of the world? Or is it to make peace with those kinds of movements, to do something different? And again, even if you are somebody who, like Francis, is the goal to consolidate his reforms by having somebody who's more of a manager, right? Francis was a charismatic person and certainly had leadership skills, but was not a kind of micromanager on the day-to-day level. Would you want somebody with less personality and more management skills, right? There's ups and downs there that they have to consider in terms of what kind of person and what kind of leader they want to have in there, regardless of their sort of like ideological beliefs.
Great stuff. Great breakdown. Thanks to Dr. Dan Rober, Associate Professor of Catholic Studies at Sacred Heart University, currently the chairperson of the Catholic Studies Department. Dan, thank you, and I'm sure we'll be chatting down the road. Thank you.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it. Dr. Dan Rober there, Sacred Heart University, our friends at SHU, Go Pioneers. We welcome back our regular Monday afternoon contributor. You read this gentleman's stuff statewide in the Connecticut News Junkie, his blog at Substack.com, Red Meat for Mushy Moderates. Ladies and gentlemen, Terry Cowgill. Terry, how are you, sir?
Hey, not bad. Would you like to buy some crypto? I'm starting a strategic Bitcoin reserve.
Yes.
And the top 200 buyers can have dinner with me at the Whataburger in Northeast San Antonio on me.
So I see you're taking inspiration from number 47. Is that what you're telling us, Terry?
Yes, he's come up with this. Every time I think he's done something that just makes me shake my head in terms of making money and marketing and stuff and stuff, he just outdoes himself, as he has with this cryptocurrency thing that he's doing. He's apparently Donald Trump is establishing a strategic Bitcoin reserve.
Yes.
Apparently has the imprimatur of the U.S. government, but he's the one who really benefits from it. As you know, these cryptocurrencies, these digital tokens are really worth nothing. They're only worth as much as people are willing to pay for it.
Sure.
But essentially he's saying, look, you know, if you buy a lot of this stuff, you'll have my ear. And you can come and have play golf with me, and you can do all this stuff. And it creates this specter of a pay-to-play deal for wealthy spenders actually selling access. He's openly selling access to himself. So this is pretty amazing. I don't know that it's actually illegal.
Well, that's the point, right? I mean, and Terry, the way the country breaks down now, right? Half the country, roughly, would hear you and say, my God, Terry, you're right about this. And half the country, just by the numbers, Terry, would hear you and I and say, yeah, all right, whatever. What time's the game tonight? You know, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I generally speaking, we've had corrupt presidents before, as you well know. And we've had some of them, you know, during our lifetimes. And I lived through the Nixon presidency.
So did I.
You did too.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw this, but I've never seen anything quite this brazen. It's just so unethical that most presidents would not do this openly because there's the shame factor, right? But if you're somebody like Donald Trump, who doesn't have any shame at all, you just go ahead and do it, and you just dare people to do something about it. It doesn't appear that there's anything that can be done about it. So we'll just have to live with it. But it still is amazing. I felt compelled to write about it.
It's good.
I felt that.
You're right. I read your piece today. I said, well, yeah, okay. But, you know, Terry, we're now to the point, I think, with this guy where it's like, well, who? Let me step back to something over the weekend. Singing songs on the steps of the Capitol to my dear progressive friends, as we saw over the weekend, that's not going to stop anything. Like, you need policies here. Am I wrong?
Well, yeah, but you know, part of doing protests and engaging in protests is not just to get attention. But I think the protesters feel good about themselves when they do this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they feel like they're doing something, and they're being an activist as opposed to just sitting on their butts and complaining. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you can complain and you can hurl barbs at the target all you want.
Yeah.
But you do have to have ideas, and you do have to have alternatives to the proposals or the policies that you're protesting. And I think that does happen with some protesters. They come out and they just kind of say, well, we don't like this, and we think this person is horrible,
mm-hmm.
and this person should leave. But they don't really offer any alternative. I'm not sure exactly if that's what happened in the case you're talking about.
Yeah, and they've got a year and a half. Seriously, I mean, you know, the midterms are sooner than people think. You also had some thoughts on William Tong, our attorney general. It's funny, Terry, with this and the whole thing with William Tong and Avello. I have some very progressive friends and some Democrat-leaning friends who gladly voted for this guy, but I've had people come up to me and go, could he please just, no, not this. This is not good.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's your thought, but, you know, even with some of my progressive-leaning friends, they're like, geez, Mr. Tong, enough. Please, stop.
Well, part of it is the job description of the attorney general in the state of Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
right? Because most attorney generals, I mean, you know, they're crime fighters. They prosecute the bad guys.
Yeah.
They throw them in jail.
Mm-hmm.
The way that the charter is written for the attorney general, the job description, is they don't prosecute at all. Or
no.
It's extremely rare that they prosecute any criminal cases.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically the state's largest law firm. They've got hundreds of lawyers, and they just go around suing everybody in sight. And so what it really does is you have people like Tong, you have people like Richard Blumenthal, and they get involved into stuff, suing people, and
mm-hmm.
they get involved a lot in consumer protection. That's what Blumenthal really likes.
Yes. Oh,
and so
yeah.
They talk about this stuff all the time. The one really normal attorney general that we had for 8 years was Jepson, George Jepson.
Yes.
Who I really liked.
A good guy. Yeah.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah. He tried to keep politics out of it. And I think we use him again. But I love this thing with Avello because, this, you know, Avello is the airline that is operating out of Hartford.
Sure.
That is signing a contract to fly these migrants for the Trump administration.
Yeah.
And so Tong got all up on his high horse and says, I want to see the contract with the federal government.
Get out of here.
What is their response?
Go.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Why don't you file an FOI request? This is perfect because I have asked the government so many times for documents, and they say, file an FOI request, and Avello throws it right back into Tong's face. File an FOI. I got so much gratification out of reading this.
Isn't that great?
I just loved it.
Isn't that great? And if you read the CEO's letter, hey, Mr. Tong, with all due respect, how we restrain our passengers on these flights is between us and the FAA and the Justice Department. Go pound sand. That's essentially what they told him. It was great. It's a great letter.
It is. It's fantastic. And it's one of those. It's one of those letters that probably, as a CEO of a company, you only get one or two chances
in your
career to write a letter that's this much fun.
Yeah.
And so I would love to meet this fellow Andrew Levy and sit down and have a drink.
Buy
with him
a drink.
And just. Yeah, just ask him, you know, what went through your mind when you wrote this letter? And were you having as much fun as I had when I read it?
Excellent. Terry, in about the 90 seconds we have left, elections in Canada today, pre-Mr. Trump ratcheting up this tariff talk, looked to be a slam dunk for the Conservatives, now not so much.
No, you know, what is really amazing about this, too, is that, there was a lot of pressure on Justin Trudeau to resign as prime minister to save the Liberal Party, in essence, in Canada, and appoint a new leader who would have a new face and all that kind of stuff. Well, it turns out, actually, if Trudeau hadn't resigned, he probably would have been saved by Donald Trump because everybody rallied around the new leader. And I'll bet they would have rallied around Justin Trudeau also because as unpopular as Trudeau was, Donald Trump is even less popular in Canada because of you know, the way that he views trade wars and trade as a zero-sum game, and then also this nonsense about annexing Canada as the 51st state. And it just enraged everyone up there, almost to a person. Like maybe 5% of the population might be open to becoming a U.S. state. It's profoundly unpopular.
Yeah.
And yes, he ensured that the conservatives are going to lose this election today.
Yeah. Folks, check out his stuff. He writes a couple of places at Substack.com, Red Meat for Mushy Moderates, and also at the Connecticut News Junkie, CTNewsJunkie.com. Terry, good to hear from you. Have a happy week, and we'll check back soon. Thank you, sir.
Thanks very much, Paul.
Right. Terry Cowgill there. Thank you, Terry. Appreciate that. You know, when you think of Connecticut coaching legends, there's one guy that was up and underway even before Carm Cosa at Yale, before Dom Perno at UConn, well before Jim Calhoun at UConn or Mr. Hurley at UConn, or well before Gina Auriemma. And he was the son of Bridgeport. And we're talking about Frank Porky Vieira, who passed away at 91 a few days ago, and he came blasting out of Bridgeport some 91 years plus ago to become an absolute legend in Bridgeport, in Fairfield County, in New Haven County. And he's a guy who still to this day doesn't get talked about as much as he should. And joining me right now, number one, is a dear friend of mine for years. We met at the University of New Haven, where he worked side by side with the Porky Vieira when Porky was guiding the UNH baseball team to incredible heights in Division II. He's gone on to a great career. Right now he's active in the Women's Basketball Coaches Association. He is active in the College Sports Information Directors of America, member of the Hall of Fame Committee, worked professionally for the Golden State Warriors for the Atlanta Olympics, but I love calling him a friend. He worked with Porky. Eric McDowell joins us. Eric, how are you, my friend? How are you?
Paul, thank you so much for this honor. It's fabulous, and I appreciate, you know, you and a tremendous show giving Porky his due.
Yeah.
I really do. I appreciate it.
So he comes just number one, he was 5'6". He comes he was born in a very rough part of Bridgeport. And I'm sure, Eric, he regaled you with his upbringing when you worked probably every day with him, saw him in the athletic department there. But talk about him coming out of Bridgeport and how he talked about that.
Well, his brother, people have to remember Gus, who could have been a major league pitcher, was a tremendous influence as well. But go back in time, and my freshman year in 78, he called me Stats.
Yeah.
I was the work-study kid. I did the book. I'm a thin, you know, shy freshman, and all of a sudden I'm learning words and learning about intensity. I'm in the dugout. I'm not going to pitch or hit. I'm keeping the book, but I'm soaking it in. I'm getting him his coffee. I'm chatting with him about the game. I had never seen anybody ever so intense with everybody, and he kept looking around. If you looked away, he'd say, stay with us, stay with us. And the one story that stands out that people would really get a kick out of before I say later personally is – you know, 1980, we finished second in the country, Paul. We got a team in California, Florida, in Alabama, and we're going out there 27-5 to the College World Series. We're playing Pomona.
Yeah.
They're 35-24.
Yeah.
And the radio announcer says, Frank, who's your number four starter? And I've never heard him called Frank before. And he looks at me and he says to the announcer, at New Haven, our number four starter is our number two starter. I mean, look at today's managers yanking guys at 4 2/3, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Paul, our bullpen, we could have planted corn in March and harvested in August.
Yeah.
We didn't have a bullpen.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
had great men that did what he asked to do. Hitters, pitchers, just a tremendous talent.
So he now, as he has told, and I remember hearing him at a dinner and also watching some stuff, you know, he grew up in a little bit of a rough section of Bridgeport. He was Portuguese. And they used to, I guess, call him Porty, which migrated to Porky, and he left Bridgeport. And before the UNH stuff, he was out of Bridgeport. He went just steaming into Quinnipiac, and he has records that still stand at Quinnipiac.
So he's in the Basketball Hall of Fame for points in a game and all of that. And the impact he made on the court was just absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. And it was so ironic to see us beat Quinnipiac. And you'd see a little emotion in him because he had so much love for the place. And he and Bert Kahn were like a comedy act together.
Yeah.
The two of them teasing and dumping on each other and stuff. It was hilarious. But it's important people have to remember he was a hell of a referee, too.
Yes.
An official who did Big East games. I went with him on a trip, and I'd never seen, and I've been in athletics 40 years, I've never seen a referee command a court where today's coaches, you know, Dan Hurley would have a tough time with Porky, let's put it that way, or Bobby Knight, because he commanded everything. He commanded the dugout, the field, the campus, and he was a tremendous official. He would keep the game under control, and he just loved the sport. But you're right. He's a legend throughout the state, and I put him, along with Gino, two remarkable people who started from nothing. Their programs were nothing, and look what they accomplished.
Yeah, I mean, he started in the early to mid-60s, UNH baseball, Division II program. And, you know, it didn't take long before, and you used to tell me this, Eric, this is a guy out of Bridgeport, you know, Frank Vieira, who could have gotten major league shots, right, as a manager or a hitting coach, but he chose to stay in Southern Connecticut.
Right, so he's starting a program around 1960, so he's pretty young.
Yeah.
You know, he was in his mid-40s when I was there, and you think about what he started, but they took a chance on a guy, and what he did was, look at the days we had the blizzard of 78, Paul. Mm-hmm. We're not playing for a week. Suddenly we've got to find a way to get a game in on Thursday at 4 o'clock. It was remarkable that they could succeed. And I think the biggest thing, I never got a hit for him or pitched, but I consider to be a part of that program because he developed good men who are now fathers, sons, grandfathers. That's the legacy. And stats aside, what he did to all of us who were part of that program, you know, personally, Paul, and, you know, it's emotional to me. My junior year, the SID left, and he went into the athletic director and said, hire Stats, and I got the job. And I think he's had as big a role in my career with the Olympics, NBA, COSIDA, all of that, as a Steve Bedrosian or Tom Banner or some of the legendary players who have played at that school. That's how much he meant to us personally, and that memorial is going to be like going to Cooperstown.
Yeah. Yeah, when you consider the thousands of people he touched. Eric, thank you. My buddy, my pal, Eric McDowell, who for some years was the sports information director in West Haven at the University of New Haven and worked side-by-side with an absolute coaching legend. He was only 5'6", but he was a giant among men, came right out of Bridgeport native Frank Porky Vieira. Eric, thanks, my friend. We'll be in touch. Appreciate it.
As we head out, he's having dinner with Cobb, DiMaggio, and Honus Wagner.
You imagine him? And
before they go to the Angels game.
And he'd run the table, wouldn't he, right? Oh, my God.
He sure would.
All right,
Thank
Eric.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Paul.
Appreciate it. There was a strange, maybe not strange, but a surprising story out of Wisconsin. You may have seen this, where a judge got arrested. Some civil libertarians are yelling over it. The Justice Department says no. This was firmly warranted here in connection with an immigration case. Let's check in now with CBS News Justice Reporter Scott McFarland on this. Scott, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the time. So outline this case for my listeners here, because it's not every day, Scott, you hear a judge getting arrested here. What do we have here?
Oh, this is novel. This is different. The federal case is against a local judge from Milwaukee.
Yeah.
According to the charging documents, according to the FBI,
there
was a defendant in her courtroom who they wanted to detain and potentially deport. And when the immigration agent showed up outside the courtroom, according to the FBI, the judge rerouted the agents to a different office, to the chief judge's office. And while they were gone, they alleged she rerouted the would-be deportee out into a hallway, and that he later tried to take off out the elevator and out the building. They're accusing the judge of obstruction, which is a federal felony, which is punishable conceivably by prison time and a large fine. But this is quite a step to charge a member of the judiciary, whereas critics say if you have a problem with a judge, you typically file a complaint or go to the judicial conference, not to the criminal code.
And did I see, Scott, and please correct me if I'm wrong, did I see there was, I guess in the judge's defense, part of her defense, Scott, that I see, it's going to revolve around the type of warrant that the ICE officers had and whether or not that was applicable to the courtroom setting they were in. Did I see that correctly?
Close. According to the charging documents, and again, this is the federal government's allegation, that's what they're alleging in court, is that she did stop the agents who are trying to get custody of somebody in her courtroom and asked if they had a warrant.
Yeah.
When they said they did have a warrant, she wanted to know what kind. Was it a judicial warrant, one issued by the courts, or an administrative warrant, one that's issued by an administrative judge, an immigration judge who works for the Department of Justice?
Yeah.
And is it a Trump administration warrant or a court warrant? That was a discussion she had outside the courtroom with the immigration agents. But she has yet to muster a defense in this case. She hasn't yet even had a chance to enter a not guilty plea. Her arraignment isn't until May 15th. CBS News has confirmed that in the meantime, she is off the bench with a temporary fill-in until she gets her day in the federal court down the road.
All right. CBS Justice reporter Scott McFarland. Scott, thanks. Be good. We'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Anytime.
All right. Scott McFarland there.